Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. And welcome to Behind the Curtain, everybody. This week, a theater podcast for you. Later in the show, we'll be talking about the show Row at the Goodman Theater. Absolutely powerful, absolutely incredible. But I want to open up with some madcap comedy that is going on over at the Mercury Theater, Chicago, one of my favorite places in the city. They do such great stuff. We've talked about Avenue Q on the show and Spamalot and so many great things. But now playing is Sheer Madness, Chicago's hilarious whodunit. And if it sounds familiar to you, it should, because the show itself was created probably about 40 years ago and ran for almost as long, not just playing in Chicago, but Washington and LA, just so many, Milwaukee, so many different places around the country. Let's talk about it and talk about what is what you're in store for when you go see it. Joining me now, a couple of actors in the show who have been with the show for, well, not just here, but for decades, if I can say that. Joe Pop, who plays Detective Nick Rossetti, joins us, and Mary Robin Roth, who we will call MR, who plays Mrs. Schubert. Welcome to both of you as longtime cast members.
Well, thank you for having us.
I should say, by the way, Ed Cross, who plays Tony, was to join us. He is on some vocal rest right now, so we want him to be just fine, and we're going to give him his vocal rest today. But we are joined by the director of this incarnation of the show, Warner Crocker. And Warner, welcome to you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I got to say hello to all of you briefly, because one of the fun things, and the way I was thinking we might open the show, but I just couldn't get access to the sound, was Act Two opens up with a little bit of a voice narration of what's going on. I'm proud to say that it is me who was asked to record that voice. I had great fun doing it, and it's fun to know that every night you guys are stuck listening to me at the beginning of Act Two. I apologize for that.
You do a fabulous job, and it's really integral to what happens in this show. It's really important. You give out some important clues.
Oh, well, I appreciate that. I hope that the Jeff nominators are listening. hey, let me start with you, Joe and MR, because both of you have been doing the show for so long. But what is it about this show, Joe, that for literally decades has kept the show going? And I'll give you one clue. It's because it doesn't feel dated.
Well, I think it's unique. It was one of the first ever to actually integrate the audience in solving a crime live on stage. And I think it lasts because every night truly is different. And the audience, as our director here, Warner, liked to say during rehearsal, the audience gets the show that they want, that they ask for, that they participate. So it's unique to those people that are sitting there that night. There are a lot of scripted stuff, just crazy comedy that people love to do. But when those they have a chance, the audience has a chance to like connect and solve the crime, and it's not audience participation. They are like inspired to help out. You know, no one asks anybody to come up on stage, or they're not uncomfortable in any way. They're just so into it, and they see so many clues and stuff. They just have to participate, and that's what makes it so different and special. And that's why I think it lasts forever and ever.
And MR, one of the things that's sort of amazing to me is because we don't want to give too much away, but yes, as Joe has told us, the audience is involved in trying to decide what happens here. And there is a section in which the audience gets to just ask you guys questions, which means, MR, you have to be ready for almost anything in terms of a question. Do you ever get stumped?
No, I always can make something up.
Okay.
I have to. It's like there's six characters in the show, but the audience is like the seventh character. If that makes sense. It's like they're also now there's another character in the show, and it's them.
And you keep us involved. And Warner, let me talk to you, because, I mean, as a director, I'm guessing it's more unusual than not to break the fourth wall. And in a show like this, you have to break the fourth wall. And yet you've got to keep your characters in character, your actors in character. Is that a challenge for a director?
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many variables involved once you open the door for the audience to be that
seventh character that you can prepare and prepare and prepare. And let's, you know, the show's had a 40-year track record, so there are quite a few questions that you can kind of predict that the audience is going to ask, but you never know what they're going to ask when they get a chance to question those suspects. And the cast has to be ready, and they have to be ready in character. They can't jump out of character or jump out of storyline to give an answer. They have to provide the witness with an answer that will defend them if they're being accused.
Joe, there is such a sense of improv about this show, just the existence of the show. I know that's it's not a thing that traditional theater can allow. You can't be, you're not doing it. It's not an improv show up there, but yet, you know, you never know. And I'm guessing if I went on different nights, one night I might hear a Joe Biden joke pop up, and another night there might be a Trump joke, and it's just all over the place. How do you guys, again, since you've been doing this so long, how do you guys interact with each other knowing that again, just so many of these today references, which is what's so much fun for the show, are going to happen?
Well, a lot of times we actually, you know, we talk before shows and we talk about things that are happening, and if something sounds like it could be funny, placed in a certain part, we'll go ahead and let each other know we're going to give this thing a try tonight, and if it works, maybe we'll do it for a couple of weeks. So when it comes to the scripted part, there's all that ad-libbing that we kind of talk about before we actually go on that night. But almost half the show is audience, you know, directing us on what we're going to do and say. And most of those ad libs, they're on the spot because we don't know how they're going to be asking this question or how they're going to be accusing particular characters in the show. So those are the kind of things you don't plan for. So that is true ad lib happening out there when they are involved with us, directing us, reconstructing what went on, or questions and answers later in the second act.
And MR, because the audience is so involved in crafting the whodunit piece, it means that you all have to be prepared for, no better way to put it, but a variety of endings for the show.
Yes, and you have to be the kind of performer that's not afraid to interact with the audience. Some actors, they don't want to take down that fourth wall. I want to just hide behind here and do my scene. Do you know what I mean? It takes courage to drop that wall and interact with the audience and be, you know, have a relationship with them. You have to be comfortable to be able to do that.
Warner, in the casting process, then, what does that mean? Because, I mean, for example, I mentioned Ed Cross, who's in it, and I'd worked with Ed back when he did the Lucy, Ricky, Ethel, and Fred show. He's got such a great personality. But everybody in this show, Brittany and everybody in this show has a great personality. Even during the intermission, they all kind of hang around on stage or in the lobby, I guess, and they interact. There has to be these characters have to constantly be connecting with people. That relationship is critical, Warner, I would guess.
Absolutely. And, you know, what you're looking for when you're casting Sheer Madness is you're looking for folks with those kind of personalities. Then hopefully they have some comfortable qualities regarding improv. But it's more about, you know, auditions are usually monologues. It's more about the interplay that you have with them when they walk in the room and when they're leaving the room than it is about the acting that they do. Because if they're comfortable, you can tell it pretty much right away.
Joe, are there any, you know, there's some stuff, Ed's character, Tony, is fairly flamboyant in his style and stuff. Your character, the detective, is anything but. And there are just things that he's done that he does that it's got to be tough just not to crack up from time to time, even if he's done something like that before. But do you guys have trouble keeping a straight face up there?
Of course. we're talking about extremely talented and funny people that are in this cast. And, you know, every night is different. And because of that, we don't know what to expect coming out of the other actors also. And they're incredibly clever and they are right in the moment. And yeah, to stay in character, you gotta really be digging deep. And then sometimes you lose the battle. Let's face it.
Now, I know during the intermission, you'll go out. People can kind of talk to you and your character. Just out of curiosity, and I'm trying not to give things away as we have this discussion, but do you hear crazy stuff? Do some people strike you as, wow, they really caught something cool here? I mean, how impressed are you with Chicago audiences?
Truly, there is usually something every night that I have not heard before. And it isn't because somebody's told them ahead of time, you know, go ask about that, which we hope they never do. It's just people see things differently and are important to people differently. You know, I had just the other night, I had someone really interested in the Kleenex that appears at one point early in the show. And they thought that that was a, you know, going to solve the murder. Everything they bring up, they think is so important. So, and I got to deal with it. You know, they think it's important, then I'll think it's important. And actually what that does is really brings a lot of comedy into the show, because we play that seriously, and, you know, it can take us into some fun directions.
And by the way, Warner, I imagine that's one of the directions that comes from you, right? Never let an audience member feel like they've just said something stupid.
Exactly. The audience is that seventh character, and if they bring something up, if they notice something on stage, heard something that a character says, we have to take it seriously. It could be the clue that solves the crime.
MR, I know you've done the show in D.C. at the Kennedy Center and in San Francisco. Are audiences in Chicago? I mean, when I talk to national touring companies, they'll talk about the sophistication of Chicago audiences. But, you know, D.C. is a pretty sophisticated crowd. I think San Francisco is, too. How would you, does it matter where you are when you do it? Or could we plop you in a city, have you do the show, and you'd say, hey, I really don't know where I am, because audiences are very similar?
They all have such a good time. They all want to have fun. They want to play. You know, and that's whatever city I've been in. And because we make it local, you know, for each city we go to, so that they can relate to the restaurant we just mentioned, or the career of my husband. It's a local career, and they love that. That, you know, oh, they're referring to my city. You know, we make it local, so it's, you know, they just want to play, right? And that's the beauty of this show.
and that is, and it's so critical. The original producers of this show, Bruce Jordan, Marilyn Abrams, and I believe they're both still around. I think they're actually still involved. Warner, do you know they're still involved in various productions? I don't know if they had anything to do with the one at Mercury.
Absolutely, they're still involved. Bruce came in for a couple of days with us early on in the rehearsal process and gave us some material that had been done in other shows that wasn't available to us when we started rehearsal, and gave our cast a lot of comments and suggestions. So that was a real treat for all of us.
So, Joe, you know, you've done some other shows. You've done Rocky Horror Picture, Miracle on South Division Street, some of those local kind of flavor things. But I imagine a show like this calls on different skills of an actor, as opposed to you've got the script to do, you do the same thing every night, and that's the way it goes. I'm guessing this is more fun, but what are the challenges as an actor?
Well, actually, this show has everything. It has slapstick comedy, door-slamming farce. It gets serious at the end. I mean, it can be some pretty dramatic acting at the end when we find out who the killer is. And then there's all that improv on top of audience interaction. There is no other experience on stage that fits all those different genres into one show. So yes, it's actually a joy, because, you know, if you do something over and over and over again, if you run a show for a long time, it gets kind of stale. This can't get stale. It's impossible. So if you really enjoy that you're going to come to the theater tonight, and it's going to be a special night. Even though it's the same show, there's this immediacy that exists with this show that it just brings joy and energy to be able to do it.
MR, you've been doing the show for so long, I'm curious, did you ever have a tough audience where Joe is the one who's really got to, it's a good Joe question, but, you know, as you're there, where it's tough to get that audience involved and you almost have to ask the questions for them? That's got to happen.
No, there was one night where the audience was just ready to just, they wouldn't let me go. They were just on me. They were just convinced that I was this and I was that, and they just wouldn't stop. They were relentless. I was like, oh, please back off. I didn't do it.
Sure. And Warner, it seems that, like, the night I saw it, it was a night that MR's character, Mrs. Schubert, could not have done it. That was kind of taken from us. Are there nights that she can do it?
Well, I'm not going to tell you who can be selected in any given night, because it's up to the audience to choose who the actual killer is at the end of each night. But let's just put it this way. Each of them have the possibility, until the audience decides that they're not, to be the killer.
Gotcha. And that's what makes so fun. And by the way, Joe, I imagine you probably have audience members going, no, it's fixed. You're always going to say it's the same person, even if it's not. You really do, because you guys, you sit, you count, you take that vote, and you really go with it, right?
We do, and I'm sickeningly honest. That's the other thing. We do our best to count votes, and votes make a difference in how, which way we go in the show. We don't like to give it all away of how it works out, but there is a point where we do take a bit of a vote to find out what people are thinking, and that does make us go in a particular direction.
Well, it's great. I also have to say, during the intermission, I kind of wandered up to the stage, and the character of Tony gave me a piece of candy, which I thought was very nice.
Bribery. Bribery.
It was a little bribery. I think he was trying to have me say he didn't do it and all of that. So I want to encourage everybody to go see it. And by the way, at the beginning of Act Two, when my little soliloquy begins, audience members, sit down, shut up, because it actually starts really quickly, and you'll miss the beginning of what I say if you're not ready for that opening of the second act.
It's the highlight of the show.
So, just great fun. Well, you know, listen, the show is, it says it's going to play through March 29th. I'm not necessarily going to believe that because it could be. So therefore, people, get your tickets by March 29th. But if it just has the history that Sheer Madness has had in the city of Chicago, one would hope that it will play longer than that. Over at Mercury Theater Chicago, where you can sneak into the candy store next door, and if you put something in your pocket, they won't catch you. I'm sorry, should I be admitting that? When you sneak in with a little candy from next door, I shouldn't tell you. But by the way, have you guys gone to the candy store where if you buy some chocolate, the woman that runs a place will tell you your fortune, MR? Have you done that?
No, I haven't, but I'm going to go do that.
Yeah, buy some. She will tell you what kind of your personality. She will tell you about you based on what you buy.
Well, I like nuts, so I guess I might be, be a clue.
That might be a whole nother meaning. Joe Pop and M.R. Roth and the great director, Warner Crocker. You don't want to miss Sheer Madness. It's up, as I said, at Mercury Theater. You can get tickets at mercurytheaterchicago.com, mercurytheaterchicago.com through March 29th. I hope maybe a little bit after that as well. We'll see. But don't miss it because it's a Chicago tradition, a Chicago classic, and it is back. And I thank you all for your time with me, and have a great run. I'm sure I'll come up to see it again, if only to hear my voice for a couple of minutes.
Hey, well, so.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, break legs. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Do you want safe, legal abortion, Norma?
Well, yeah. I mean, I ain't here for the pizza. Dope. What do I got to do?
Well, we need a pregnant woman who wants an abortion to challenge the Texas law.
That woman is called the plaintiff.
And you wouldn't even have to use your own name.
We'd use a pseudonym, so your privacy would be completely protected. Mm-hmm.
And usually people use Jane Doe, but since there's a Mary Doe in a related case, we could use something like, say, Roe.
Roe. Like fish eggs.
So, I'm Jane. Roe.
Well, the point is, you wouldn't even have to appear in court.
And then I could get my abortion.
Norma, the law takes time. I cannot predict how long this case will take, but I can only promise you that we will do our very best. Do you want to do this, Norma?
Well, I never said no to a fight yet. No, like you say, things got to change.
Thank you, Norma.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And there is the beginning of one of the most powerful cases in Supreme Court history that remains a battlefield today in the world of abortion law. Welcome to a discussion of the show Roe. It is playing at the Goodman Theater through February 23rd. And I got to say, ordinarily, I would do these interviews much earlier in the run. I didn't get a chance to see the show until recently. It blew me away. And I contacted the Goodman and I said, please let me talk to Christina Hall, who plays Sarah Weddington, who is the lawyer for Roe, Jane Roe, in the case of Roe versus Wade, who, along with the incredible talent of Kate Middleton, who plays Norma, who is the actual Roe in the case, they present a case that present a play that may not be what you think. Let's get to it and let's talk about it. Christina, you've been at the Goodman before. Wonderful town, feathers and teeth, so many great things. You're amazing in this role.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been an honor to get to play it.
So before I saw the show, I'm a lawyer, and I thought, okay, we're going to get the story of Roe versus Wade here. You know, heck, I teach that case. It's not that simple, is it? Tell our listeners exactly what they see on stage as they watch Roe unfold.
Yes, absolutely. The play makes a focus on presenting both sides of the pro-choice or pro-life argument through the two women who really were responsible for presenting the case. Sarah Weddington, who was the lawyer who argued and won the case alongside Linda Coffey, her cohort in law, and their plaintiff was Norma McCorvey, or Jane Roe, to keep her anonymity. So we see both of their storylines presented, Norma's from a personal standpoint of life events that lead her from one position about the case to another. And we see Sarah Weddington, who keeps her personal life pretty quiet. You see her ongoing fight to not just win the case, but to maintain what it fought for and arrive at a different place by the end of the play together. So, yeah, it definitely prompts the discussion to continue outside of the door of the theater on your way out.
Indeed. And one of the things some people may not know and that we learn while this play was written by Lisa Loomer, we come to realize that over time, both Norma and Sarah actually wrote their own books with conflicting accounts of exactly how all of this played out.
Correct. Yes. And what's fascinating as an audience member is there's only a few scenes where you see Norma and Sarah interact and real time together in terms of the events of the past. Most of the show is them presenting arguments to defend their side. But in the moments where you do see them interacting, you see the same events occur, and you see them both interpret it differently, simultaneously. And so the arguments they present may not be different from the events per se, but what they took them to mean were. And that, of course, changed the course of both of their lives.
And I don't want to give too much away because I think so much unfolds, especially when you think of Jane Roe or Norma as a person. People probably have their own sense of what she was like. I was stunned, even though, as I said, I know the case of Roe versus Wade, but I really didn't know Norma's true background and whatever. So I don't want to cross any lines. So what would you tell listeners now who haven't yet seen the show, what you don't mind them knowing about Norma if they don't know that full story?
Certainly. Norma is someone who, which you learn immediately in the play, her life has been hard from the start. She's been a victim of sexual abuse and assault multiple times in her lifetime. She's someone who has had children that she's had to give up for adoption prior to becoming pregnant, prompting Roe v. Wade as a plaintiff. And so you get from the beginning how complex she as a person would be if they were trying to argue the case to the Supreme Court about, particular situations in terms of rape or incest. And they make a point very early to say this is not about those situations, just about whether a woman has a right to do this. But setting that up, that shows you how Norma's life just lives on the wind, kind of at the mercy of the people she surrounds herself with. And that's her pattern throughout.
Out of curiosity, did you... or any of the cast members, did you read the biographies of, that Norma and Sarah had written, or you were just concerned about the script, didn't worry about doing that part of the homework to see how they differed in the past?
Yeah, a lot of us did the homework of reading the books before we got in the room. Some of us relied on the very thick, thorough, beautiful dramaturgy packet that Jonathan Green put together for us. It was twice the size of our script. It was remarkably informative. I know Kate read both of Norma's books, which have contrary storylines within themselves. I definitely spent some time with Sarah's book, mostly to try and find some personal information about Sarah, who's a very private person. So a lot of the research regarding her had to do with legal research on my part, just understanding, making sure I understood everything to honor, how clever she was in the courtroom. And in life.
Yeah. And by the way, Sarah, we come to learn sort of the fates of most of these people. It's a bit stunning to realize how many are gone now.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah's still around, but so many, including...
She is, and still fighting the same fight.
Yeah, and Norma herself died just a couple of years ago. Out of curiosity, because this is so... if people have their views about abortion, there are people who believe in abortion rights, and there's people who are completely pro-life. In talking to audience members afterwards, or just feedback that you get... Do you feel that the show leans one way or another, or does everybody walk out sort of with ammunition for whatever their side is in this debate?
Yeah, that's a really great question. What I will say is that while the show presents both sides, how it manages that is it presents one side's point of view, and the other side presents their argument to that, and that goes back and forth on either side. So I will say people aren't necessarily going to change their mind, because usually people come in with a pretty firm standpoint. It's hard to completely turn someone around. What I will say is this play certainly prompts people to think about people on the other side of the line, to think about the fact that everyone comes from somewhere, everyone's trying to do their best, you know, and to remind ourselves that there needs to be compassion in whichever choice is being made, that it is from a place of humanity.
And so this, I'm going to keep this as a fair question. I'm not asking your position on the issue or anybody else's, but let me ask you this, or Kate, was there anybody who came into this with a view on the issues and had trouble with the role because the role took it into a different, you know, different end or made things difficult, give it into, because these are such core beliefs that this case involves.
Yes.
Or as actors, do you step in and go, you know, really, it just isn't relevant. I have a role to play.
Sure. I mean, all of those things, really. Some people in the room volunteered the information of where they fall on the party line. Some people aligned with what their characters thought. Some did not. And there is, I mean, just the nature of this content carries a lot of emotional labor, even if you do align with your character's point of view. And the additional work, which definitely some of our actors were representing the opposite side of what they felt, it took an extra level of empathy because this is such a... Everyone feels so emotionally about this in terms of why they're making their decision.
So, I'm curious. So that discussion and realizing you have these views, was that part of the rehearsal process where the director and dramaturge people getting you together to talk about things, or was it just because you all went out to eat during rehearsals and the issues came up?
Yeah. It definitely was a really safe space in terms of there was no prodding of what our personal beliefs are, because, you know, really it's nobody's business unless we want them to know it. But there was certainly room to talk about it. And just like in the play that we present all sides, in the rehearsal room, we have to follow everything up with facts because this is a history play. We are portraying real people. So there definitely was a closer eye on the here and now and how that informed everything we're doing.
As a lawyer nerd myself and as somebody who teaches constitutional law, I thought one of the great, I don't mind giving this away, but the Supreme Court case itself is actually Act One. That's all that goes with it, including the Supreme Court. So this is not a play that ends with the Supreme Court decision at the end. Far from it.
Correct.
Too much happens after that. Yeah. So that's why people who are saying, oh, I know the case, I know how it comes out, I don't need to see this. No, you don't get it. That really just Act One. But what I thought was really cool, the nerd in me, the fact that it's clear that the script is using the actual voices of Supreme Court justices as they pose questions. So there you are playing lawyer Sarah Weddington, having to respond to questions posed to you by a Thurgood Marshall or a Harry Blackmun or one of the justices at that time.
Yes. That was one of my favorite things, because one of the few things I could really find about Sarah was the recording of the Supreme Court, you know, other than interviews of her. It was like such a perfect little nugget of research. And she is just so in control, so commanding, even though she's expressed since then how terrified she was. She was running late because her husband had messed up the water. She took a cold shower. Her hair was wet. You know, but if you hear her, you would never know she was a 26-year-old who was frantically getting to the courthouse to argue the biggest case of her time. She's remarkable. And so getting the opportunity to kind of deal with that back and forth with the actual voices of the justices of the time was next level. You really get to drop in and feel like you are a part of something that was great.
In Act Two, as I said, that's all Act One. Act Two is kind of the aftermath of it all. And I think, again, I did have some background in this, but if you don't know what transpires with Norma, you might be a little surprised at how her life takes direction.
Correct. Yeah. Especially like the difference of Norma's private life versus her public life.
Right.
There's so much to mine there. Kate has done it so beautifully, truly.
And all the extra, I mean, Raymond Fox, just everybody who's part of that ensemble cast does such a wonderful job. It really is powerful. I'm curious, let me go back to the earlier question as far as you having the discussions. Did anybody, as a result of doing the show, now that as you only have over about a week left till the 23rd, Did anybody go through a transformation or a change as a result of doing this show? Not that you change your inner core beliefs, but perhaps a greater awareness than people had before? And I'm talking about cast members.
Sure. Yeah. Actually, I think most of our actors have expressed that, no, it did not make them change their mind. However, it did inform them in a way that made them more aware of why they were making that choice, so that it was based in something factual as opposed to emotional, in terms of, you know, this is a matter of the Constitution and the rights of people according to the law, not according to one specific belief that's meant to be applied to everybody, you know. So, no, nobody had a huge, like, turnaround about that. But audience members that expressed this, there's just so much history surrounding this case, especially the specific language used in the courtroom, that people just are not aware of. And it does shift how you think of it.
Why do you think the play was called Roe? I mean, one could say, oh, well, it's all about this. Well, it could have been called Roe versus Wade. It could have been called Norma. Mm-hmm. It could have been called Sarah.
Yeah.
Why, in your opinion, as you think about it, was it called Roe?
I think, first and foremost, Lisa Loomer, our very brilliant playwright, even in the, you'll recall from the show, there are ensemble members who move around about the space and set the scenes. They change the costumes of the actors on stage, and they are women who are doing that. Even predominantly the cast is female. We have three very lovely gentlemen who are incredible listeners in our cast, too. But Lisa made a point that this is a story told by women. So to include Wade in the title, nods to Henry Wade, the Dallas district attorney, who was the other side of this whole case. And it's not about him. It's not about men. This is about women's rights and their bodily autonomy. So I think to call it Roe and not Norma or Sarah makes a difference, because Roe, the case, became both of these women's whole lives at a very young age. They were thrust into this situation, both for very different reasons, but Roe is what was attached to both of their identities forever.
And I think lest people think when they see the name Roe that they know what they're in for, they know what the show is about, whatever, they really have a lesson coming to them. Out of curiosity, what do people say to you? What do you hear as you maybe leave the theater at night on your way out, other than fans telling you how great you were, like me? But what do you hear?
Yeah, it's fascinating, truly. One, I have a very great advantage that I wear a blonde wig in the show. And when I come out, a lot of people do not recognize me. So I can move through the crowd very, unassumingly. And so I've had the pleasure of moving with the audience all the way to the train and hearing the conversation continue all the way home, in terms of not just talking about how wonderful the costumes, the set, and lighting are, which they are, talking about, oh, I did not know that. I've never even heard of Sarah Weddington. I didn't even know they said that. They never even talk about rape in the case. Oh, my goodness. I can't believe that's happening right now. So those things are thrilling to hear. And what has been such a true honor personally is the number of women who have felt safe enough to share their own stories in relationship to their abortions with me, which is so personal and takes a lot of bravery to express. And so as a woman who is very privileged to have a microphone in her hand representing all the women Sarah Weddington fought for, I'm very much trying to use that privilege to honor these ladies who went through numerous different circumstances to make sure they had the life they wanted.
Did you ever go off the train and just turn around and go, that was me, thanks?
No, but I did have a woman who somehow took the train all the way to the same stop as me, hop off the same platform and come quickly at me, which startled me at first. And she was like, oh my gosh, you're Christina. I just realized. I kept looking at you, but now I realized you were Sarah. Oh my God, you know, and it was very kind. And once I got past the fear, I was very flattered.
I love it. One last question. There are a couple of times you sort of look to the audience, you break the fourth wall, you ask us some questions. I like kept wanting to respond to you, but didn't think I should.
Yeah.
Do people respond? Yeah. Do you want us to respond?
Absolutely. And we want them to. Because, like, something that is very lovely about this show is, yes, we break the fourth wall a lot. The first time you meet Sarah right away in the play, she's asking people to raise their hands in response to questions. So we do long for some participation because, one, we all deserve a voice in this subject, of course, with our vote. But also, it's important for audience members to realize the people around them may not agree with them. And here we all are in the room, finally having a moment where we're listening to both sides of it. So I think that is a really engaging part of the show as well. And by the end, when we're in a town hall situation, we long for people to chime in. We've heard everything, you know, lots of amens and wants to castrate the men. And, you know, it gets pretty heated sometimes. So
yeah, that's
exciting.
That made me uncomfortable. Okay.
Yes, it made me uncomfortable too.
Well, Christina Hall, you are fabulous in the role of Sarah Weddington, the lawyer for Jane Roe. The show is Roe. It's at the Goodman Theater only till the 23rd. Ordinarily, I give people a lot more time to go see things. I will tell you, I've already sold several tickets for you from people who have just said, you need to go see this, and they are. So
thank you, Paul. Word of mouth is the best.
That's the way to do it. Tickets can be gotten at goodmantheater.org. Theater is spelled the proper English way, T-R-E at the end. I'm so glad Goodman does that. And congratulations to you, and I'll look forward to seeing you in the... Can you tell me what's next up for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I am performing in Kinky Boots out at Paramount Theater in Aurora in the spring. We start performances in late April, May.
Oh, fantastic. I knew that's coming there. You'll be working with Jim and all my friends out there. Fantastic.
Yes.
That is an incredible theater performing. You're about to have a great time.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
And as a friend of Jerry Mitchell, I can tell you, it was great fun to deal with in the past. Congratulations on that great role.
Thank you. All right.
Christina Hall, incredible actress. Don't miss her in Kinky Boots, but don't miss her now in Roe over at the Goodman Theater through February 23rd. Thank you, Christina.
Yeah, thank you, Paul. Have a good one.
You too.
Can you feel the bass making my heart race? Lose yourself tonight. I'll get lost in your eyes. Lost in your eyes.
And that is from a song called Freak Boy. It was quite a hit for the artist who wrote it and sang it. His name is Adam Mardell. He is an American singer and songwriter. You may know him with his work with the pop duo Second Alibi. And he's toured with Aaron Carter, Romance on a Rocket Ship. That song, actually, that you listened to held the number one spot on CD Baby's Top Synth Pop Songs for 5 straight weeks. And he's got some new and exciting news coming up, so I wanted to chat with him. And Adam Mardell, welcome to the podcast. Good to talk to you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You are most welcome. So, you know, I mean, here you are. You live in Chicago now. This is your home, and yet you kind of, in some ways, live the rock star life around the country with a real job and real. How do you balance it? Is it sort of a split life for you? There's the onstage rock star part, and then there's the I'm just Adam part.
Yeah. So I used to be a full time musician. I used to be signed to Sony Cobalt. When I was in the group Second Alibi. And now I'm doing everything part-time. So, you know, half of it, I actually work in a pharmacy. And
that could be a setup for some jokes, and I won't even...
You know, going on tour and doing all this crazy stuff. So it's a nice balance.
So talk about the pop duo Second Alibi, which that's really what kind of gave you some fame and all of that. Where does that stand? Is any chance that group comes back?
Yes, actually, about a month ago, I had one of the original members reach out to me, and we're talking about potentially doing a tour, and we're, you know, starting to write some new music. So, you know, it's a really exciting thing. I'm not sure that all the original members will come back, but, you know, ultimately that's our goal.
Well, there's lots of groups that come back. You keep some of the original key players and everybody else you trade in and out, right? Just ask Paul McCartney.
Right.
He'll trade in a few Beatles and get some wings and all of that. You know, you've been in the music industry for a long time. You've written music for other people. Which is your passion? Is the watching other people perform your music, or is it the doing the performing, maybe along with Aaron Carter or some of the folks that you've played with? Which one are you all about?
Well, originally I started out as a songwriter, and that's kind of where I got my start before I ever started releasing music. So that's actually the part of the industry that I really enjoy the most. I never went into the music industry wanting to be a performer, but it happened for me. And, you know, I'm in no way saying that the performing aspect was, you know, dull or boring or anything. I absolutely loved it. But yeah, when I went into music, I always wanted to be a songwriter.
And so you get to perform your own music, like Freak Boy, right?
Right.
So what is coming up for you? Is there kind of a different, because Freak Boy actually was, we go back, it's about a few years ago or several years ago that you wrote that. Is there a new flavor mm-hmm. to what your music is now? Is the music scene, unfortunately, I'm so old fashioned that I couldn't define the current music scene, but is the music scene changing right. and it's influencing you and how you write?
Yeah, well, when Second Alibi broke up in 2018, I was actually starting to work on a new record. A new solo record. And around that time, my mom had actually passed away. So I ultimately put that on the back burner and was going through a really difficult time a number of years ago. And now I'm wanting to write, you know, from the heart and, you know, talk about some of those experiences. So it's definitely going to be more grounded and personal this time around.
You may be sort of answering this question, but it makes me want to ask you, how have you changed as a music writer over the years? I mean, it sounds like life experience informs your writing, but how would you say you're a different writer today than you were back in maybe 2012?
Well, when I was, you know, younger, starting out in the industry, I kind of had this formula. So, you know, you would basically go in a room with different producers. I was signed under BMI back then. And you would go in these recording sessions, there would already be a track and you would kind of write to the track. It's actually called being a top liner. And this time around, I'm able to build the melodies, the lyrics, and everything from the ground up. So it's much more personal. Even though I am collaborating, it's people working around my original ideas instead of me coming into something that's already been developed.
And how would you describe your music? I mean, when you're sitting down to write, I mean, you know, listen, I play with lyrics. Lots of people probably pretend they're songwriters, but you have to be mm-hmm. able to hear it, right? Not just the lyrics. You've got to be able to hear the instruments that are behind it, the chord progressions. Right. How does that happen in your head?
Well, I've actually been a musician since I was about 6 years old. I grew up playing the guitar and eventually got into piano in my teen years. So what I hear first is actually the instrumental melodies and the vocal melodies before I even come up with lyrics or chord progressions or anything like that. So it ultimately starts with this idea, you know, of all the instruments that are on the track. And it's very odd, but like I actually visualize, you know, what the music video is going to look like. And yeah, so.
Listen, you're not that old now. I mean, as a young guy, and again, I know you recently lost your mom, and I'm so sorry for that. But yet, I have to mm-hmm. ask, what kind of support? It had to be critical for a young musician and songwriter to have family support. I can see a lot of moms out there just going, please go get a real job. you know, please go get your accounting degree. What kind of support did you have? It had to be good.
Yeah. My mom, you know, originally, I think I met a producer in 2008 on MySpace, and like 6 months later, I was living with him. We were sleeping in the studio. It was very crazy. So at that particular time, like my mom thought that I was just making a mistake. But ultimately, when it started paying off and, you know, I toured with Aaron Carter and all of that stuff was happening, she became more and more supportive and actually realized that music was more than just a hobby for me. It was something that I had to do.
So as you go back, and I know you said there's possibility now of a new tour for you, writing new mm-hmm. music, is that a frightening experience? Is it an exciting experience? What emotions are you feeling as you get ready for the next chapter?
Ultimately, I'm nervous, but excited. You know, it's doing, you know, the whole pop scene thing again it's very crazy, you know, now that I'm 30 years old. So I'm going into it in a different state of mind this time around. So I know the ups and downs. I've been through, you know, bad situations with labels and managers. So I kind of have my guard up. But yeah, I'm really excited to get back out there and start expressing myself again.
So I went to your website. It looks like it's under development, so I imagine you have a new website coming.
Yes. The website will actually be launching, I believe it's in 2 weeks officially, with like the tour dates and everything coming up. I'm also working on a memoir, which I'm very, very excited about. Yeah,
that is exciting. So give us the website so we can send people to it.
Okay. the website is adammardell.com.
Right, easy enough.
Right.
And I know a song that you'd written before, but it's going to be released on the new album, is called Hit a Wall. Tell me a little bit about that, because I want to go out playing a little of that.
Yeah, so that was actually a song that I wrote years ago, and I kind of put it on the back burner. But now I'm starting to revisit it. It's actually about being in a relationship that is difficult, and you're not really sure if the person's the right fit. And yeah, it's a lot edgier than, you know, what I think people are used to.
Well, we're going to get to listen to it. Encourage people to go to the website to find out about your upcoming tour and new music at adammardell.com. Give it a little time. It'll be operating and functional soon. And make sure you mention the podcast in your memoir. I'd like that to give us maybe a paragraph in there.
Absolutely. Okay.
Open a chapter with it. It's very exciting that way, I can promise you. Adam Ardell, I thank you for your time. We're going to go out playing what is certainly going to be your next hit up as it hits the charts soon. I wish you good luck with it. And we're going to go out playing Hit a Wall by Adam Ardell.
I'm over with putting my love on the line. So sick and tired of you wasting my time. Starting to think I'm better off by myself. Driving me into the arms of someone else. Thought you could give me but have had enough. Say that you're sorry but have given up. Tell me you want me when you really don't.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from behind the curtain.